Savior, may I learn to love thee, walk the path that thou hast shown. Pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own.
Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
And I believe this was... Oh, actually, Daniel, what year? We're 2014. Okay. In the fall of 2012, which was 6 months before John came out, North Carolina actually put up a vote. North Carolina put up a vote on basically marriage equality. And the way that the bill was written, it said you were voting on whether to define marriage between a man and a woman, and as a subset of the vote, you are also voting to not allow civil unions to be allowed for any same-sex relationships. Uh-huh. So it was a very stringent, I guess, proposition.
Yeah.
And so I went out and looked at it, and at that time I was for traditional marriage, and I was also for calling it, I was for two people of the same sex to be allowed to have civil unions or something like that. I was a stereotypical, let's use a different word, marriage we'll use for male, female, and let's call it something else for same sex. And that was my political stance, mostly because I really had never thought about it that deeply. So
yeah.
But when I got the when I went to go cast my vote, I went and I read the proposition really carefully, and it seemed really unfair to homosexual couples because it was written so far right, and so I voted against it, and so in a sense I was voting pro-gay in that sense. Even though it didn't quite fit with my political stance at the time, because it just seemed a little bit too aggressive.
Yeah.
Meg and I really never talked about that. She went out and voted the same way, but come to find out later, and keep in mind, this is 6 months before John came out, so come to find out later, when the vote all came out, it was, I believe it was a 70-30 win for traditional marriage. And it was, at the time, and it may still be the case, it was the biggest margin of defeat or victory, however you want to describe it, to where the traditional marriage won out. It was 70-30, or I think it was actually 69-31, was the split on the vote. Yeah. And there's 100 counties in North Carolina, and only 3 of the counties as a whole voted pro-gay, if you will. And that was actually bothered by that, and it kind of upset me because it made me realize, man, these people are really behind the times, and that's coming from somebody that was still pro traditional marriage. And so, you know, a couple months after that, when we had found out that, in hindsight, I'm very grateful for the way that I voted in that particular case, because it makes me feel like I wasn't. You know, I was probably a bigot at some levels, but I wasn't at least, you know, so far gone.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things that made me feel like, oh man, I can still remember. Well, I go back and think how, I guess I go back and think, how would I have looked at things now, or how would I have looked at things before if John hadn't come out? And so that was one of the defining things that I know how I was then. I can go back because I actually made a political move on how I looked at the whole situation. Anyway, so during this time, Meg's sister Kylie was dating her boyfriend Andy. you know, Meg's sister was 21, 22 years old at the time, and they were almost engaged, and we had all friended him on Facebook. He was going to be the next brother-in-law and the next uncle to all these nieces and nephews, and of course he was going to be John's uncle in the next probably 6 months. I had my suspicions already, having never spoken to him or never talked to him or messaged him or anything. Just through visual stereotypes, I had my suspicions that he might have been gay.
Yeah.
And I even shared it with my boss at work. I actually put a picture of Andy up, a Facebook picture, and I asked my boss at work. I said, "When you see this picture, what's the first thing you think of?" And he goes, "He's gay." I was like, "Okay." That was his very first thought, which is interesting. And I know that's horrible to stereotype, but it was there. It was there regardless. We both had that thought. And so in January, we got a message from Kylie, Meg's sister, that her fiance boyfriend had come out, you know, to her as gay, and they'd broken off their relationship, and he had never really realized how important it was for him to be honest. He could lie to himself for the last 10 years, but he couldn't lie to Kylie because he loved her too much. And so, so he came out to her, and it was devastating to her. And I would imagine it was liberating slash devastating to Andy at the same time. And that was kind of the end of it. I mean, he didn't really disappear, but we were all still were friends with him on Facebook. Nobody unfriended him, even though we knew that their relationship wasn't going anywhere. And he was starting to figure out how to be gay in the Provo, Orem area and reconciling that with his faith and everything. He'd only been off of his mission for about a year. So that was happening, and so John came out in March of that same year, 2 months later. So in those 2 months, John essentially started to explore ideas about himself. He told us later, he said, the thing that really kind of caught him off guard or made him a little bit aware, I don't know where he was, but he saw two men that were kissing. And I don't know if it was like super passionate, but they were just sharing a moment that he witnessed. And he'd never even considered that as a possibility, like in life. And when he saw it, something inside of him, he said it just felt right. He said, he'll talk about it. He wasn't aroused, if you will, but he just said it just seemed right. And that got him to start thinking differently, because his whole life that wasn't right, and so he decided to kind of let his mind explore that a little bit, and to figure out why that was. And so he had a classmate in seventh grade at school whose name is Gabe, who we'll actually talk about here in a minute. And Gabe is completely out. They used to walk together. On Fridays, there was a frozen yogurt place that was about a half a mile from school, and all the kids would walk up to the frozen yogurt place, and there was 50 to 100 kids at this frozen yogurt place, and they all hung out, and they came home later. So he and Gabe would walk up to the frozen yogurt place together, and they would start talking about, I guess, sexual orientation, even though they certainly didn't describe it that way. And Gabe had always had girlfriends since, like, second grade. He'd just always felt the need to have a girlfriend, you know, whatever a second, a third, fourth grade girlfriend meant, he always had one. So they would talk about that, and Gabe confided in John that he thought he might have been bisexual, because he was a little bit confused on who he was attracted to, because historically he had girlfriends, but now he was feeling things towards guys that he never really allowed enter into his mind. So he thought he was bisexual. So John and Gabe talked about that a little bit, and some of what Gabe was saying resonated with John. So John felt like, well, maybe I'm bisexual too. I'm not really sure. So they had these conversations, but you know, it's 2 seventh graders trying to figure this out with no help from anybody except 2 inexperienced people, each other. And so at some point in there, probably in early March, John decided he was on Facebook, which he's never on Facebook. And he jumped on Facebook and saw that Andy was online, and he and Andy had never exchanged messages or anything like that. I think they'd been introduced maybe through Facebook, but that was it. And, And so John sent a message to Andy, as a 13-year-old would. You know, his ultimate goal, he just wanted to open up this dialogue with Andy. And as you can imagine, a 13-year-old talking to a stranger that he knows is gay, trying to, using Mormon missionary term, BRT, build relationships of trust. He reached out to Andy. He goes, he's like, "Hey, Andy, what's up?" You know, and they had this really weird conversation for a couple of minutes. And then as John was trying to establish some kind of basis of a friendship, and then finally John just said, "Andy, I want to ask you a question." And Andy said, "Go ahead." And he said, "How did you know that you're gay?" And so Andy answered it. Andy was really cautious about it because as a gay man, when you've got, I mean, imagine you've got a kid going through puberty asking you that question, you're probably automatically, your awareness is pretty heightened. And so he was cautious from the very, very beginning to not overly share, because he had an inkling at the very beginning. He knew why he was asking him the question, you know, or knew, or had a suspicion, I guess. Because a straight kid doesn't ask that as often as a gay kid would. So, so Andy very tactfully answered John's questions and was trying to basically be Andy was trying to essentially be a gay role model, somewhat of a father figure, for this kid who didn't know, was trying to figure it out. And he was being very, very careful because this is his ex-fiance's sister's kid, and he doesn't want to mess, he doesn't want to kind of, I guess, get into affairs that are none of his business, but at the same time, he knows what it's like to be 13-year-old and gay and not be able to talk about it. So he was very tactfully handling the situation, and to ask this of a 22-year-old who had only been honest with himself for about 7 weeks to handle this is a completely unfair unfair task to put to this poor guy. And so they exchanged conversations, and they would literally talk for probably like an hour to an hour and a half, and it was all through Facebook text chatting every night for like a week. And John was asking some very, very adult oriented questions, and just for John's privacy, I won't get into them, but he was using very adult verbiage and proper verbiage. You know, he had obviously Googled.
Can you just clarify things. That? You don't mean adult as in like he was talking over about sexual things, but he was using it a mature language, level of.
I will give an example, and not that he even said this, but just so you know what we're talking about. He called the male genitalia penis. He called the women vagina. I mean, it was very, very medically accurate, using clinical terminology.
Okay.
To address any topic that that was being discussed. So John had obviously done his education, and he was being had done his fair amount of research, as much as he could find off Wikipedia or wherever, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but he's not learning anything from porn sites or anything like that. Just for clarification, we've gone back and talked to him about this in detail because he was looking for truth, you know, on the topic. And so they talked about all kinds of things, even inside the church and outside the church. He stumbled upon some of the quotes that President Kimball had mentioned about masturbation leading to certain things, and all of these questions were just bouncing around in his head, because this was not something that he could talk to his friend at school about, because his friend at school is not Mormon.
Yeah.
So he was coming from a little bit of a different, I guess, perspective. So they talked all about this, you know, and they talked about some of the feelings that John was having if he saw a picture of a guy with his shirt off versus a picture of a woman in a bikini, you know, like a straight 13-year-old might feel if you saw a woman in a bikini versus, you know.
Right.
So they're having these conversations, and John's comparing his thoughts with what Andy was saying he went through at that age. And Andy, again, Andy is, I mean, well, John kept telling Andy, he goes, I think I might be bisexual. And Andy, he said, yeah, that could be possible. You know, he just let John go with it however he felt like he should. He was very, like I said before, he was very careful not to suggest or influence John's self-labeling, if you will.
Yeah.
So anyway, this went on for about a week. And just so it's clear out here, we have a rule in our house that we do not allow computers in the bedroom. We've never had, you know. So John was like sneaking this to have these conversations with Andy because they happened at like 12 to 2 o'clock in the morning because that was the only time that John could kind of do this, you know, because he wasn't ready to talk to us about it.
Yeah.
And so it was the only time that he felt like he could do it. And he didn't have a phone or anything like that. He didn't have his own. So he would sneak the laptop in and have these conversations. So that went on for a week. And finally, at the end of – it was a Wednesday night. And finally, John came down to the conclusion. He says, Andy, I think I'm gay. You know, after a week of conversation, John came up with that, his own conclusion that he was gay. And he was pretty sure of it. And I mean, he had prayed about it at this point, asking, you know, he's like, I think I'm gay. Is this okay? You know, and he felt, wonderful, I guess, what's the word? Help me out with the word that he was like,
affirmation.
Okay. So he would pray, he prayed about it. He came to the conclusion. He came to the conclusion that he was gay. He prayed about it and felt a complete confirmation from his God, his Heavenly Father, that that was okay and that he was made that way, and it was made that way for a reason. In this same feeling and understanding, he also knew that he shouldn't be quiet about it. And so he told Andy, I'm gay, and the very first thing that Andy said was, you need to tell your parents. So that was his very first bit of advice once John came to that conclusion, which I applaud Andy incredibly for over and over and over. We owe Andy everything for that one bit of advice. And John said, okay. And he did the next day. So between the time that John and Andy had that, between the time that Andy had given John the advice to tell us immediately that he was gay, he got online again. It was about basically 24 hours, and he started looking about a couple of things. He learned about the closet. He really hadn't never heard of it, and he started looking at it and researching it and realizing what a dark and depressing place it was. And it freaked him out and it scared him. He said, "This is not for me." And so so somewhere in that time too, he Googled 101 ways to come out. And you've got to know John. He's a quirky little witty, funny kid. Everything is really lighthearted, and he's a deep thinker, but everything's lighthearted with him. And so he thought he would be funny, because for him it was no big deal. So he thought he would tell us in a really funny way.
Yeah.
And so the next night, we were in the process of moving out of our house, and we actually rented a steam cleaner. We were cleaning our house, and Meg and I was boiling water, dumping it in the cleaner, and Meg was steam cleaning with the hot boiling water. Anyway, during the middle of this, and John pulled Meg aside while she was upstairs and I was downstairs boiling water. And he came in with a game of Hangman, because that was one of the 101 ways to come out. Someone said you could play a game of Hangman, telling somebody that you're gay and have them guess the words, I am gay. But instead of doing that, knowing John, and this will tell you a lot about John, he thought it'd be funny, and he created the phrase, I am like Andy, in a game of Hangman. And he stopped Meg and he said, let's play Hangman. And so she was guessing letters, and she figured out I am like Andy, and she kind of was confused, and she initially said, you mean from The Office? From the TV show, the Steve Carell TV show, The Office. Andy is a character, and that was a show that all three of us watched. I mean, he just recently had been watching them all with us. We told him he could watch it when he turned 13, so he was in the middle of watching it. And so that was where our minds were. And he shook his head, and he just wrote at the top of the hangman to Meg while I'm downstairs boiling water. He just wrote the words gay. And Meg, you know, went up to him and she said, John, are you telling me that you're gay? And he just nodded his head because now he was being in that situation. He was a little bit more scared, I think, than he had thought it would be. So I can't speak to that. And I think Meg has probably already talked about that because I was downstairs. So after 10 or 15 minutes of them just chatting, it was quiet. And I was wondering what was going on because I had water boiling everywhere. And I came upstairs. I'm like, "Hey, what's going on, guys? You know, like we're paying per hour to rent this thing. Let's get this thing going, you know." And I walked into a room, and it's just like really serious and really somber. And like, I was like, "Oh, what is going on?" You know. And I was like, I'm literally in my mind. I was like, "Did somebody die?" And I had the thought, "Meg and John are right here. Okay, so they didn't die. So at least that's good. My two favorite people didn't die." And so I sat down, and Meg was like, John just told me something. And she said, John, do you want to tell your father? And he wouldn't even look at me. I think he was scared to death of me, which is not something that he ever is, I don't think. We have a very open relationship like that. But because Meg had been crying, and I think now he was worried about my reaction. He came into this whole thing all lighthearted and thought it'd be funny. And he thought we'd say, I'm like Andy. We're like, oh, sweet. You're like Andy. We have another gay. We've got a gay kid. Awesome. I think that's how in his mind he had envisioned it. And Meg kind of freaked out in tears. And John, misunderstanding what her tears meant, you know, she thought she was crying that he was gay. And she was just kind of crying for the future that she had anticipated, knowing that it was going to be different. And not really having ever considered what the future of a gay kid would be like. And ultimately it's the same thing, but there's enough significant differences that you're going to go through, especially as a Mormon family. There's not a temple marriage there. And in our ignorance, we were thinking, he's our only son. We're not going to have any grandbabies. He's not going to be married in a temple. He's not going to go on a mission. He's not going to be an Eagle Scout. All these things are the initial thoughts that are going through your mind. One, because we're not educated. And ultimately, the only one of those that was really true is that he wouldn't be married in the temple. And, you know, but we didn't really know. This was all new to us.
Yeah.
And so so he wouldn't look at me. And Meg said, John, do you want me to tell him? And he just kind of nodded as he was like staring at the wall. And she looked over me and she said, John just told me, like she told me, matter of fact, John just told me that he's gay, you know, and I was, and my face just, you know, I can't imagine what my face was, but he wasn't even looking at me, and I just kind of let it process. I didn't say anything, and Meg was like in tears, trying to hold back her tears for John, but he wasn't looking at either one of us, and she was mouthing things to me. She was basically saying the words, he told me he was gay, or he's gay, but she's mouthing to me something along the lines like, shaking your head like in absolute panic and saying things like, I don't know what to do. What do we do? What does this mean? You know, like she's mouthing these phrases to me that she's scared to death of what this means. But she's saying the words, he's gay. I told him it's okay. We love him, you know, but she's mouthing these other things that are just expressing her fear. And I'm just frozen, not really knowing what to do. And I'm just letting it sink in. And what I've told people before is it wasn't surprising to me that he was gay, but it was still shocking. And to explain that, it was or to explain what I mean by that, there were certain stereotypes that he had when he was younger. He had a couple gender identity issues, I don't know if you'd call it that, when he was two or three, and his doctor said, half the kids I see deal with this at some point, because this is the age when they start to recognize that there even is gender. Yeah. So a lot of kids just kind of go through it as they're figuring out where they fit. Most kids just kind of grow out of it, and other kids end up being obviously trans or gay or lesbian or whatever. and that was pretty much it. And so he kind of grew out of it at like 4 or 5, but it hung around longer than probably what was normal, whatever normal means. And you know, he's a little bit effeminate, in some ways, but not overly. He didn't like sports. Incredibly gifted in music, you know. So all these stereotypes that he kind of fell into. So I had the thought, obviously, growing up that he might be gay, but until he was gay, he wasn't gay to me.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. And so when he told me, like I said, I was shocked, but I wasn't surprised, especially because the previous year he had started talking about girls, which he never really done before. And one girl in particular that he had actually even mentioned he could see himself marrying. And so in my mind, we were kind of way past that.
Yeah.
You know? And we had settled in, to me anyway, we had settled in on a possible future path for him. And so that's why it was more shocking. So, and Meg probably told this story, and it's probably better from her, but I will tell you what I said. I didn't even remember that I said this until she reminds me. John and I had this thing for the previous 5 or 6 years that we both really hate tomatoes. I mean, I can't even get them down, Daniel. If I took a bite of a
you
tomato.
You hate tomatoes? I love tomatoes.
I will throw up. If I take a big juicy bite of a tomato and chew it up, by the second chew, I'm like gagging. I can't get it down. But
that's sad. John, I have to say that's really sad.
It is sad, I know.
Tomatoes are awesome.
But to me, they're not, and so it's not sad, right?
Okay.
So for me, it's great that I don't have to eat tomatoes. To me, it's like,
yeah,
it's like eating, I don't know. I don't know if you like Vegemite, but Vegemite from Australia is the other thing that I just can't do. It's the grossest thing on the planet to me.
Well, I'm with you on that one.
So imagine. So you're not sad that you don't like Vegemite anyway.
Yeah.
Same
I'm
thing.
Not getting the big loss in life from that one.
Right. So I feel the same way about tomatoes. It's just it's an inconvenience because I always have to order without tomatoes.
Yeah.
But all right. Beside the point. But so John and I, he knew that about me, and I told him that when I turned 15 or 16, I decided that I was going to take a bite of a tomato once a year and try to overcome my dislike for tomatoes because it was an inconvenience that I wanted to be gone. And so I did it once a year. I took a bite and I would take a bite and I would always end up spitting it out, but I committed to doing it once a year and hopefully I would grow out of it. And I did this until I was about 28 or 29 years old. And eventually I'm just inflicting unnecessary discomfort on myself. And so I stopped doing it at 28 or 29. I was like, I just don't like tomatoes. If I did, I would have fixed it by now, so I can't. So we joked about that, and so he said he was going to start doing that, like the year before that. So we were out somewhere, and he took a bite of a tomato, and he's like, "Oh, that's gross," and he spit it out. The irony now, Daniel, is that he actually can tolerate them now because he's been doing it for a couple of years. So he's hoping that he'll be able to grow out of it. So I just figured I should have started it earlier. So anyway, this is
a while for his sake too.
What's that?
I hope for his sake too.
Right. So this is a big tangent.
Tomatoes,
but to really set it up to fully understand the meaning of what I'm about to tell you, this makes sense. So finally, after probably sitting there, I probably sat there for 15 seconds. It felt like 15 years of just silence. As I was processing things, and I remember just like snapping out of it. And this will go with other things that we've talked about before, that you pointed out in my history of dealing with gay individuals, is that you've said that, I typically put the human first in front of the quote affliction, if you will, because I probably looked at it like that.
Right.
And so I just kind of like turned off my emotion for a second. I said, "You know what, John? Here's the deal, man. I hate tomatoes. You know, I mean, imagine this is a conversation. It's like John says, "Dad, I'm gay." And the next thing out of my mouth is, "It's all right. I hate tomatoes." So I say, "You know, I hate tomatoes. I feel like I was just kind of born like this. This is the way it always is going to be. Everybody else loves tomato. I hate them. And that's just what it is. Some people like tomatoes, some people don't. And it doesn't make you a better or less of a person. It's just who you are. And it just doesn't really matter. And so that was my weird way of telling him, whatever, you're gay. I don't like tomatoes. It's pretty much the same thing in my book. So that was my reaction. And knowing John, I think he understood what I meant by that. but looking back on it, it's so bizarre that that's what I would say in that moment. But so anyway.
Well, Jake, I have to tell you that the other day, since you had told me a little bit about the tomato story before, this is the first time I'm hearing it, it was in my head. And just the other day, someone was telling me how they were sure that being gay was a choice. And I was like, well, I never chose, you know. When did you choose to be straight?
Right.
And it was a group of people I was explaining this to. And so finally, I thought of your example. I thought, oh, well, but I changed it to broccoli. I thought broccoli would be a better example for just a random person. Some people like broccoli, some people don't, but they don't choose to like it. They just do or they don't.
Right.
So anyway, your example made sense to me so much that I incorporated it into my life and blessed the lives of others using that same idea, just so you're aware.
No, that's cool. That's cool. That's funny.
Yeah, but broccoli. I have to change to broccoli because there's probably only three people on Earth. There's probably only three people on Earth who ate tomatoes. And
that's probably true.
You two and my friend Meredith. And you guys are weird. So I just had to use a real example that someone could relate to, because who else doesn't like tomatoes? I don't know.
That's funny. Broccoli is mine and John's favorite green vegetable. So
okay.
But well, anyway, but that's consistent with tomato haters. So
yeah, there you go.
Anyway, so I say that, and he's starting to loosen up a little bit, but we're still not talking. It's still uncomfortable. I'm still processing everything. And Meg is telling me some of the thing. Meg's telling me the Andy story a little bit because they had already talked about it. I asked him, maybe Meg did. I asked him about the conversation. He said he told us he wanted us to read that conversation.
Uh-huh.
And I think it would have been easier for him to explain it through actual events that transpired.
Yeah.
Versus him having to say it all again. And I tell you what, so we read it that night later after he went to bed. Well, I should say first is that was pretty much it. I mean, it was late. He had school the next day and he went to bed. I mean, we didn't get deep into it. He kind of like got it off his chest, if you will. Now Meg relayed this to me of what he said when he told her, and I'm sure she's mentioned this too, is when he told her, after he told her, he said, hey, Mom, I've been doing a little bit of research about this thing called the closet, you know, and it's not for me, you know, and he used words like, I'm gay, God knows it, I know he made me that way, and I need to tell people. Other people need to know, because there are certainly people around me that are also just like me, and they're living in this darkness. And I think part of it, he was referring to his friend Gabe, who was really struggling. Yeah. With how to handle this, and I think he realized that he needed other people to know so he could be there as a friend to Gabe and other people. So he literally said the words. He said, "I can't be in the closet. I need to be a beacon of light for I need to be a beacon of light to others who are like me." And so the whole closet thing was a foreign thing, someplace he just wasn't gonna go down.
Yeah,
but not for him, for other people. And that's just, if you know John, that's just typical John. You know, he's such a sweet, sweet kid, and he thinks about things that way.
Well, I mean, that's great. He went online, he found out that there's all these people suffering in the closet, and he knew he didn't want to be there, but he also felt like he also got the idea that people come out of the closet in part because of examples set by other people who are living happily out of the closet. And so that's kind of inspiring that he went right to that idea that he wanted to be one of those people showing how to live happily so that other people would realize they could do the same.
It's exactly right.
That's exactly where one would want your 13-year-old to be, but it's not easy to imagine that most 13-year-olds would go right to that. So that sort of speaks well for John's sort of, you know, self-esteem at the time, that it was intact and that he was able to, you know, go directly to an affirmative kind of idea like that. That's really great.
And he's such a deep thinker, and he always has been. And when we talked to him about things, we learned really young that we could explain complex concepts to him and he would get it.
Yeah.
And that was fun to me. I explained algebra to him at age 6, and he understood like the concept behind just algebra, like solving for x. He couldn't really do it, but you know, it was that thing. I was just telling him about it, and we talked about stuff like that. I mean, that's a bad example, but because he understands life examples too, and why people choose things, and we would talk about very advanced concepts, I guess, at a young age, and that's always interested him. And so it wasn't too surprising that he would look at things through other people's perspectives instead of just his own.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a typical 13-year-old kid. I mean, he plays video games, and we have to beg and pry him away from the video games to come eat dinner or whatever it is. You know, I mean, he's certainly self-centered, if you will, in that way. He's not just some all-encompassing, compassionate person. All the needs of everybody else is in front of his. But in this scenario, he got it. He understood it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we explained birds and the bees to him at age 8 or 9 because he was asking questions that he wouldn't let it go, you know, and we were able to explain things to him in ways that he understood it, and he got it, and it wasn't weird to him. It was just like, oh, okay, that's how it works, whatever. Where was I? So he went to bed, and Meg and I had time to spend together to talk about this. You know, our world was basically upside down, and the first thing that we did is we went and we read the conversation with Andy, and it took us about 30 minutes to read the whole thing. I mean, there was a lot of dialogue in there, and so we read it, and it was more than this, but let's just say it's 10 pages long. It might have been about 10 pages long. And at about 2 pages in, as we're reading it, we're not reading it out loud. We're just scrolling through it together, reading it at our own pace. And about 2 pages in, I realized, because he had said something in one of his questions, I'd realized right there, I'm like, that's it, he's gay. Like right there, on something that he said, I realized I was like, it's clear. There's no doubt to me that he's gay right there. But John didn't realize it until like 8 more pages.
Okay.
You know, and it made me, and I could tell that Andy knew it too, in how he was careful with his conversation.
Yeah.
And now talking to Andy, you know, we've kind of confirmed that with him. Like, yeah, he pretty much knew early on that he was gay, but he let him figure out. And I was, again, so grateful that Andy just let him work it out. But here's the biggest takeaway from having that 10-page dialogue. It wasn't so much having, it was cool to be able to see a conversation with John and Andy about him figuring it out. But we basically have 10 written pages of John's mind as he's coming to the conclusion that he's gay. Let me say that again because I stumbled through it. We basically have 10 pages of being in John's head as he's coming to the conclusion that he's gay.
Yeah.
And what parent could ever have that? I mean, that's like gold to us, you know. And so when we end up talking to our bishop later, and I'll get to that in a minute, but it was so clear to us. We never struggled with, is it a choice? Is it not a choice? Is he gay? Is it a phase? That was never even on the table for us because we were in his head. We saw, we understood it like he understood it. So we feel like we had a really good blessing. Maybe he was blessed that we had that because we never had to question him on it.
Yeah.
You know, because it was just all laid out. So that was a great experience for us to be able to read that. And
furthermore, you got to confirm. I mean, people would always wonder, well, what were they talking about? Why is my 13-year-old talking to an adult? But you had the chance, both because of your trust with your son, to review that, but also you got to confirm that indeed Andy was being totally appropriate with with John and just giving him helpful advice that would be appropriate for an adult to give to a 13-year-old, right?
Exactly. I was about to mention that in reading that 10-page of chatting, our biggest takeaway, other than obviously John being gay, was the way that Andy handled it. I could not have asked for a better person with better perspective and handling it the best way as possible that Andy did. We don't really know this, but we feel like we potentially owe Andy John's life. I mean, if he handles it differently and he, you know, and then John's takeaway is something very different that turns him feeling guilty about it.
Yeah.
There's no telling what would happen. The worst case scenario is that John's not here, you know, anymore. But he easily could have just remained closeted and who knows what would have happened.
Yeah.
But Andy was being so appropriate, so gentle and careful, making sure he didn't cross a line, with John. That, I mean, Andy's our biggest hero.
Yeah.
You know, and Andy's so humble about that. You know, he's like, I just didn't want to mess anything up. That's what Andy kind of will say. And
yeah.
But he has no idea how wonderful or wonderfully that he handled it. And so we didn't meet Andy in person until like 6 months later. But to this day, I mean, I don't know how he fits into if he's like a nephew or a brother, but he fits into our family as much as anybody and will forever. The obvious thing that Meg and I had to handle at this point was how to control when and if and how he came out.
Yeah.
He was going to come out. And this was springtime, and we were like, how do we do this? Because John just wants to tell everybody, but we're like parents, and we're concerned for his safety. We don't know how his peers are going to handle it, and we didn't want him to suddenly get shoved into lockers or whatever. We just didn't know, and so we were going to try to slow play it. Now, oddly enough, Daniel, the very next day, that Friday, and I should go get the date, it's like March 23rd or something like that, it was when the Supreme Court, made the rule. They made the announcement that they were going to make a ruling on, what is it? Help me out here. They made
DOMA and Prop 8.
Yeah, I think so. The ruling didn't come until like.
Well, this was in March. They decided that they heard the arguments in March.
Okay,
so and everyone then, like, was posting April or May. About it. So there was a big talk about it in March, and then we sort of knew, March or April, around there, and then we sort of knew that it was going to be announced in June.
Okay.
That's my recollection of
that. Well, whatever that was, the day that they announced that they were going to hear the argument was the next day. That's my whole point, was that Friday.
Okay.
And the reason that that made sense or that mattered is Facebook. Suddenly on Facebook, I'd never had seen or heard of the red equal sign. That was all new to me.
Yeah.
Didn't know what it was. And on Facebook, that symbol was everywhere. And I was like, what is that? And I looked into it, and I saw what it was. And Meg and I kind of looked at each other, and we were like, how lucky. Facebook people right now, before anybody knows anything, we made these mental notes of like friend or foe. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Or who we would have to be careful of or who we knew would be supportive right off the bat.
Yeah.
Church members, non-church members, just all of it. And it was very interesting to see there was a lot of people that were surprising on both directions or on both sides. But it was like we just made all these mental notes. Like, friendly, got to be worried about them, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway. And there was a lot of family members who were very actively on Facebook that we were like, okay, These are going to be difficult, you know.
Yeah.
And some of them still are, but so that was kind of nice, but so back to we were handling how to come out, and ultimately we talked a lot about it, but what we decided on was, okay, you've got 2 more months of school. Let's not tell anybody at school yet, you know, because we were worried about school more than anything, because that was kind of a those were a bunch of people that we didn't know. That was more of an uncontrollable environment for us as parents. Yeah. We thought we would write a letter to the ward, specifically emails to individuals in the ward, and let them know, and let them know to that John was going to be telling people, and we wanted to give them an opportunity to filter that information to their kids as they deemed appropriate. Yeah. So it wouldn't blindside them. We were trying to be respectful to our ward. And we thought we would do that. And so he would be out at church, and then we would have the summer where he didn't really see people at school. And then when he came back to school in the fall in eighth grade, he could just kind of just come out, you know? So that was how we thought was a pretty good plan to slow play it. And he agreed, you know, he's like, yeah, okay, let's do that. So we started doing that, but we also realized really quickly that that was not going to happen because John felt like he had a calling and a mission, you know, really to an answer to a prayer that he needed to tell people.
Yeah.
Because there were people that needed to know, you know, and nothing that we did was going to stop that. But he was also trying to be respectful of us. He wasn't just going to tell people because he thought that he's like, oh, you're my parents. I'll kind of do your plan. So he leaked it to like a couple individuals that he could trust. You know, he would come home. I told two people today, and he would tell us who they were. I'm like, okay, you know, so we started to realize, I was like, oh, this is going to be hard for us to control.
Yeah.
You know, because he just had to do it. He could not keep it in. So to start off with, I've drafted a letter. Meg drafted a letter to her brothers and sisters to tell them. I drafted a letter to the ward. We included a piece of Meg's letter into my letter. I threw some statistics out there. The letter's all over our blog that we currently have that people can read.
Yeah.
I went through the ward list, and I literally looked at every name that I recognized. Even if I couldn't put a face to them, if I recognized the name, they got the letter. I did not want to send this email to inactive members who had no idea who we were. It just seemed weird. But I didn't want to leave anybody off the list either. So there were probably about 250 names or families that we at least recognized that got the email.
Uh-huh.
Just in our ward, and a couple people from the other ward that met in our building that we knew well. And so that was it. And I hit send and just kind of sat by the computer and waited. And then ping, 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 responses started to come back. And they were all positive. You know, hey, we love you guys. You know, wow, how brave, all this stuff. Everything positive. One person even sent one back, and she was trying to be so sweet, and it was probably the one person that we were kind of most worried about. She sent a response back that said, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry for this tragedy that's happened in your life. We're praying for you. We love you. We support you. You know, hopefully you can overcome this ordeal," or something like that.
Yeah.
And it could have kind of gotten us really upset, but it literally made us laugh because I was like, she tried in her total misguided understanding. She tried to be nice about, she tried to be nice about this. It's like she was trying to be nice about us getting the news that our son was going to hell. And she was trying to be sweet about it, you know, and it was hard to be upset at it, you know, because we understood where she was coming from, even though we're like, ah, it's okay. You know, she doesn't get it yet. So it was kind of a funny thing. So, but that was what it was. We got probably 200 replies. Some of them, there was a lot of reading between the lines of some people that we were like, we might have to be careful here, you know, and then some other people reply, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm really surprised at this reply. And some people were so open and they wanted to learn and know how we felt, you know, and they were really, really awesome about it. But we learned really quickly after that initial period of just welcoming, accepting, that it was not going to be nearly as easy as we thought it would be. And I'll jump to that in a minute. But so after that initial coming out at church. It was just a couple of weeks later that he was going to come out at school, and we knew it. And we finally said, dude, go for it. You know? And he was thinking how he was going to do it. And I remember on the way to school that morning, I took him to school, and he was thinking about different ways to do it. And he asked me, I was like, this is what I would do. Cause it's not a big deal to you. I wouldn't make it a big deal to anybody else. you know, I don't think it needs to be a big announcement, because in my mind, I felt like that's what you're trying to stop, is making coming out a big deal. You want it to be a normal thing and not a big deal. You know, in the future, that's what we want as a society, I would think.
Right.
And so I suggested to him, people had asked him that year on occasion if he was gay. He'd probably got that question 15 times throughout the year, you know, and he was like, no, because he didn't, at the time, he didn't think he was.
Yeah.
And I said, just see if somebody asks you. You get asked it often enough, a couple times a month, you know, see if somebody asks you. And if they ask you, just say, yeah, like, that's it. And he was like, yeah, I can do that. And so he was just going to wait for that to happen because he liked that idea. And it was something like in the first or second period at school, somebody asked him that day.
And he just
oddly enough, and he goes, yeah, I am. And they're like, wait, really? He's like, yeah. And he treated it like no big deal, and it was kind of no big deal. And by the end of the day, it had spread throughout the school a little bit, you know, because about 50 more people asked him later that day, hey, I heard you were gay. Is that true? And he's like, yeah. And so it was like no big deal. And nobody at school really cared, which was awesome. And he came home, he goes, yeah, pretty much everybody knows I'm gay. We're like, and? He's like, and what? And nothing, you know? So that was the best news in the world for us.
Is this drawing kids from a relatively progressive community, or?
We lived in on the border of the other city that was like the two cities that voted I mentioned earlier. We lived in a very liberal area. Chapel Hill, North Carolina is probably the most liberal city. I'm sorry, Chapel Hill, North Carolina is by far the most liberal city in North Carolina.
Okay.
And it's not even close. I mean, it's more liberal than a lot of Western liberal cities. But
okay.
And we lived on the border of Chapel Hill. We lived in Cary, North Carolina. And we had a lot of people from other countries, and there's a lot of culture there. It was not very Southern.
So it was a place that was more likely to be a safe place to come out.
If you could come out anywhere in North Carolina, we were within 10 miles of probably the best place to do it.
Right, okay.
For him. The church, that's a different story. The church is a church, and the church is rooted in conservatism no matter where you are. So,
there's so better and there's worse, though.
As
far as places go,
but it's all seen through the lens of conservatism. So that school wasn't a big deal. Church over the next couple of months started to become a big deal as we realized we would engage in conversations with people that were just exhausting, and I felt like I was having to defend my kid from the judgments of hell. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When he was no different than any other 13-year-old kid who didn't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. He just was a 13-year-old kid who now knew that he was attracted to guys instead of girls.
Right.
And not doing anything different. But, I mean, there were definitely some things that Meg and I had to deal with. Just comments and people automatically making assumptions that we were going to raise them a certain way, and then engaging in arguments is strong, but engaging in dialogue to make sure that we were going to raise him in a celibate life when they learned that we were going to raise him to be what he wanted to be. I think that shocked a lot of people, and people had a hard time with that. And we felt a lot of judgment, and so many people pulled me aside, so many people, and said, are you going to leave the church? And I was like, and I had said and done nothing to suggest that at all. Nothing. And, I still had my firm beliefs in the church, and I still felt like that's fine if the church says it's a sin and that, you know, all that. I was like, that's fine, whatever. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't really care. We're going to raise our son to be happy and we're not going to raise him to have him think that he's on the potential of being a sinner or whatever, in the eyes of God. because we wanted to protect that. The biggest gift in all of this was him not having any guilt, any self-loathing, any self-doubt with who he was and how he was created. And that was our number one goal in all of it, in how we were going to handle it. That was number one. And then the church and family and everything else came secondary.
So you recognized right away that you didn't want him to have this narrative playing out in his head that he should feel guilty for wanting to have intimate relationships with a man or to pursue a relationship with a man eventually.
Right away.
You knew that this wasn't a healthy way for him. What made you realize that? I mean, what?
I don't know. It wasn't even a realization. It's just what it was. I mean, guilt. I don't know. I mean, it just wasn't. It just didn't feel right.
Okay.
Somehow
you got there right away to realizing that no matter what your church teaches, it's not good for my gay son to get this message that there's something wrong with him or wrong with this.
Yeah. I mean, right away. And now, but, you know, the day before, I would have argued the opposite. You know, I would have said, yeah, you probably need to live celibate life. It's a sacrifice, you know, like an alcoholic needs to stay away from alcohol. I mean, I looked at it like this stereotypical traditional Mormon believing, but that piece of it was immediate for me.
Because once it was your son looking at you and you kind of feeling, knowing your son and just feeling empathy that you felt for him all your life, you immediately felt empathy about that what would that really mean to him?
Correct. And here it is, Dan. It'll put it, this probably will put it as plainly as possible. In the whole history of my thoughts towards gay people was being gay was, in the church, you had to be celibate because being gay was about sexual relationship. I mean, that's what the church was saying. You can't have a sexual relationship. It never occurred to me that not having a sexual relationship also meant not having any relationship.
Yeah.
You know, and that, so it never even occurred to me in my 39, 38 years of being in the church thinking about it. It was just, you can't have a sexual relationship. And as soon as it was put on John and I realized what that meant, I realized, wait, this doesn't mean that he just can't have a sexual relationship. He can't have love. He can't have any relationship. And it was the first time I'd ever thought about that.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, that seems like the biggest cracker crap unfair to do to anybody when we are commanded as a people that, I mean, the number one thing that we are really supposed to do in this church is to get married, have a family, or I should say, fall in love, get married, have a family, and then endure it to the end. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the goal. And then you take that family unit into the next life. I mean, that is the purpose and the goal of this life. There's some ordinances and stuff along the way that you got to do, but ultimately is life. That's it. And now you're telling me that the main thing in life that we're supposed to do, my son can't do.
Yeah.
And that just didn't make any sense. It felt like a contradictory of commandment. So I'm like, okay, I would rather choose, if it's two different commandments, I'd rather choose the one where my kid's happy. I have to believe in one or the other.
Yeah.
And so that's how I saw it from the beginning. It's weird though that I never even let my mind go there before that.
Yeah. Well, there are lots of people out there who think that gays or gay teens, by adopting this narrative that, you know, that they can only be happy in a gay relationship. This isn't me talking, by the way. This is, but there are certain people within Mormonism who think that gays should try to prepare themselves to have this unselfish marriage where they're not doing it for sexual attraction, but they're doing it for more Christ-like love. And I mean, it's not making sense to me, but I just want to put out there and get your response to that. I mean, what if someone had come along and explained to you, oh, I'm gay, but I have such an amazing love for my wife, and even though we don't have this strong sexual attraction, or I don't have it. I love her a lot, and I'm following God's laws, and I'm building for something better. Were you just not exposed to that idea at all, or did it never occur to you, or if it had occurred to you, would that have impacted you differently, or?
No, it did occur to me, but it occurred to me secondary to the other. And so initially I was like, he can do whatever he wants. And then as I kind of had that thought, I started looking into it. And people started sending us, I mean, left and right. And if there are any faithful Mormons out there who are listening to any of this, the probably the last thing to do is, and I love this guy, but the last thing to do is send people links to Josh Weed's blog. It's because my interpretation of this, when people would send that, and we got, I don't know, hundreds of people like just saying, have you read this? Have you read this? Because to me, my interpretation, it was like, it's like they came across Josh Weed's blog and said, hey, look, there's still a chance for your kid to be straight. All hope's not lost. I mean, that's the way I interpreted it. And I think that's kind of what they're saying. Like, oh, he doesn't have to be cast out. He can still be with a woman. It's possible. And it really got under my skin. And Josh and I have talked about this. But it got under my skin so much that I started to resent Josh Weed and his relationship with Lolly. And that was so unfair to Josh. And so I reached out to Josh on Facebook, and I opened up a dialogue with him, and I told him everything that I'm saying here because I wanted to know Josh, because I felt bad because it had nothing to do with Josh. It had everything to do with the people that were sending me Josh's life and wanting to apply that to my son's life.
Yeah.
And so we talked about it, and Josh was the first one to say, he goes, no, I don't recommend this to anybody. You know, he said, this works for me. And I love my wife, and I love my kids, and this works for me, you know. And it's hard at times, and blah blah blah, you know. But he's the last person that would say that his path is for everybody.
Right.
And so that was really reassuring to me. And then it allowed me to, when people would send that again, it would allow me to reply to that and say, oh, thank you for sending this to me. Josh and I are good friends, and then I could actually teach them.
Yeah.
I could actually teach them something about Josh's relationship that Josh wants people to know, but people don't usually go deeper than here's a gay guy that married a woman and now he's living a straight man's life.
Yeah.
People don't go deeper than that. And so I was able to teach people that sent me that link a little bit about Josh's life and what that really meant and how that applied to a gay man. When I would reply, nobody ever replied back. Because I think they didn't like the reality that I was giving them.
Right.
That because I kind of set them straight that I'm like, no, that's not the answer for your gay kid to be straight. You know. So that was liberating to me to be able to do that. But Daniel, it was one of the hardest things for me. It was one of the hardest emails or conversations for me to have when people would bring up Josh Weed. And it still happens. It doesn't happen as frequent, but I still. About 3 weeks ago, I got somebody sent me that email. Hey, I look what I discovered. Thought you might be interested in this. You know,
yeah.
It's old hat now. It's, right. It's you know, but
yeah, I'm interested.
But man, that
this is
really
the 1,000th time somebody encouraged someone to send me this. But
I know. But it really irked me at the beginning. You know,
yeah.
Because to me, it was just like you're not going to be accepting of my kid unless he's plays the straight man's game.
Yeah.
Anyway, we dealt with that.
And Josh Weed's, Josh Weed even pointed out that he was concerned that parents, you know, you were getting it from other people, but a lot of young gay people get it from their parents. Their parents just grab onto that and say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do this? You know.
Well, and that's why I felt like I needed to educate, because all these other people who are sending it to me, they were all parents. And they all have kids who are under the age of 10. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so hopefully that one little thing would help them realize, okay, well, maybe this isn't what I thought. So to answer your question about that is I quickly realized that wasn't the best route in most cases. And then I also learned, and it just took a little bit of research to learn, that the church really doesn't, they don't recommend that. They used to. I mean, that was President Kimball's antidote to being gay before.
Yeah.
Marry a woman. Fast, pray, marry a woman, stop masturbating, and you'll be all right.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's not even meant to be funny. It just kind of is. But
right.
That was the antidote, you know.
I was part of that generation.
Yeah. No, yeah. You. Yeah.
For that, yeah.
Yeah, you get it. And oddly enough, little side note, since we'll add a little bit of humor in here, when we moved, you know, when John told us, you know, we were in the middle of a move, and we quickly learned some of the verbiage in Miracle of Forgiveness by President Kimball, and Meg was so distraught by it. We had two copies of it on our shelf somewhere, and she threw both of them in the trash when I was at work one day.
Wow.
Yesterday, literally yesterday, I went on Amazon and I bought one because I want one, you know. I want it as a reference point. And she was like, I don't want that in my house because I don't want, if we die, I don't want people to think this is part of our collection. I'm like,
yeah.
So it's kind of a funny thing. I was like, yeah, but I want it. I want to have it as a reference, in case they ever stops going in print, and they, you know, it's like I want to have one. You know, maybe just to have 20 years from now or whatever. Yeah. You know, it'll be important for me to have that documentation in print.
Well, it's so important right now. I mean, hopefully nobody's reading it anymore, but unfortunately people are. And I really hope it goes out of print really soon. But the one thing that we need to remember is that the church has changed. I mean, if anyone says the church hasn't changed, all they have to do is go read the Miracle of Forgiveness, read the rhetoric from the 80s, read the rhetoric from the 90s, and read the rhetoric from the 2000s, then read the rhetoric from the website, and you will see that there's a clear progression in a positive direction. I mean, it certainly hasn't come far enough, but nobody can go and say the church doesn't change its attitude about homosexuality. That is so easy to prove that it's false. All you have to go do is go look at things like the Miracle of Forgiveness, and it's really obvious the church has changed.
Sure.
So nobody can argue that the church isn't going to change its mind about homosexuality, because why would they stop changing it now after they've been changing it on a regular basis for the past 30 years, right?
Right.
And that gives us room for hope, because it is a more enlightened place they're at now than they were before. And I don't know, it's hard for us to know exactly how they got there, but somehow someone has opened up their eyes and realize that there's a few things that they were doing wrong, such as the Miracle of Forgiveness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason kind of to keep it around, at least as a reference point for people who are interested in these issues, right?
And in defense of the church, I will use, it is a fairer word to use, is that the church has evolved.
Yeah.
And I'm comfortable saying that. Because I think members of the church feel more comfortable using that terminology, and I'm fine with that. But along the same line, there's plenty of room for more evolution within the doctrines of the church on this topic. And that's, like you said, I mean, that gives hope for the whole situation. So, but going back to move my timeline along here a little bit, And I won't go into great depth over this, Daniel, because one, I've written this in our blog, and I've written this recently, and I've probably most accurately described it there. But short while after this, Meg, there was a pride parade in DC that Meg wanted to go to, wanted to bring John. John's friend Gabe, who now was out at school, and his mom came with us, and I kind of went a little bit begrudging, stuck my heels in the sand a little bit, because I just wasn't quite ready for that. I mean, I was still homophobic, might be a little bit strong, but there were certain elements of that to me. Uh-huh. I wasn't ready to see men in drag. I just wasn't ready to be part of that. You know, for everything that I had seen in the gay community, the gay pride, it was just a little bit too much for me yet. You know, I mean, a gay 13-year-old who was my kid that I knew was fine, but people dancing around it and being, and quote, I'm doing air quotes right now, expressing themselves in certain ways that just I just quite wasn't quite comfortable with. I didn't want to go, you know, but they wanted me to go, so I went, you know, and I kept a lot of these feelings to myself. I just kind of went, put a smile on my face, and went, you know, not knowing what I was going to do. But the short story is the pride parade changed my life. I mean, we went there as Mormons. I think there was like 40 or 50 of us that were marching, and we were giving hugs to all we did is we just hugged people that were there at the event. So we went up along the side and we just hugged people. I probably gave out, I swear, 1,500 hugs that day.
But were you? So the idea was a Mormon was hugging a gay person,
right? Yeah, I hugged people when we were given stickers that said "Hugged by a Mormon." So we gave a hug and we gave a sticker, and there were plenty of adequately dressed individuals that I would hug and no problem. And there were a lot of very, very underdressed individuals that I was really uncomfortable hugging, but yeah. I made a point to not distinguish between the naked guys and the dressed guys or the dressed girls. I didn't really see any naked girls, but and by naked, I mean almost naked.
Half naked.
Right.
Scantily clad.
The 99/100th naked.
not to get arrested, but okay.
Right, anyway, right.
Not naked.
The legally naked. So,
yeah.
But I went out of my way to. I didn't want to be the guy who only hugged a certain type of gay person. You know what I mean? Because I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be that guy either. So, you know. So anyway, I hugged everybody willingly, but there was one person in particular that I hugged, and he was a young guy who told me as I hugged him, and I, you know, you have time for about a half a second hug in a moving parade, yeah. And I hugged this guy. And he didn't let go, you know? And so I said, oh, okay, I guess we're not letting go. And so I hugged him back and he was not wearing a lot of clothes, but he was a very good looking young 20 something year old guy. But he basically relayed the following info to me in the brief few seconds that we were embracing. And he said, you know, he was a Mormon, he served a mission. He felt like God, hated him. And he essentially implied that us, as Mormons, which were like his people,
yeah,
you know, also his people were the ones that were persecuting him the most, you know, through his eyes,
yeah,
which I think is fair, that we were there, now we were representing him, and we were letting him know, even though there was only 40 or 50 out of the millions of us that were there, letting him know that we loved him, he basically implied that us being there just saved his life, you know, and I mean, that moment, like, changed me. Like, it from that moment through the rest of the mile and a half of the walk, because that was fairly early on in the parade, I was instantly changed. All my reservations about any kind of homophobia that I had, and any of that uncomfortableness that I had with hugging these half naked men, it was gone. And I immediately, everybody in my mind, at that moment forward, was perfectly equal, and I moved forward like at that point. And the rest of the parade was amazing, you know. And then I started kind of going out of my way and hugging the people that I was probably more uncomfortable hugging at the beginning, because
yeah.
I felt anyway. so it was an amazing experience. Anyway. And so we came home from that, and I was forever changed.
Just this probably isn't that relevant, but just curious. So Gabe and his mother went. Did they hang out with the Mormons too, or?
Yeah, Gabe and his mom. They marched with the Mormons,
even though they're not Mormon.
No, they were not Mormon. I think she was Catholic. That I'm not sure. Right wing conservative, and she flipped on a dime when Gabe came out. So she was wonderfully supportive. So that was awesome to hear. So she was off and running, you know, being active in her own right.
Yeah.
But, you know, she just wanted to come up and participate and be part of something.
Yeah.
So, you know, they loved it. And you go and look any of the pictures from that weekend, they're all over it, Gabe and his mom.
Okay.
They're all in those photos everywhere.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, so I mean that was a great weekend. You know, that was a definitely a pivotal moment for me. And then we kind of moved on, but we started to feel, I'm going to kind of jump ahead a little bit here, Daniel, to get things going for sake of time.
No problem.
You stop me if you want to, I mean, you know most everything about all of this, so you stop me if you want me to include something. I began pretty active on Facebook, getting into a lot of private support groups because we didn't really know what to do. Meg had kind of started this issue, if you will, started to raise a lot of questions in Meg's mind with the church. And she started researching a whole lot of other things that really had nothing to do. They started with the gay issue. I keep calling it the gay issue because I don't really know what else to call it. But
yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, okay. So she started to research a whole bunch of things around the gay issue, and it kind of led her to some other things. And it just raised all kinds of questions. And so she started digging around and looked up some of the history of the church and some things that were just didn't seem to fit with her. And, you know, and it kind of actually in a weird way gave her hope because she was like, oh, well, if they were wrong about this, then maybe they, you know, this non-gay thing, then maybe they are wrong about this gay thing. And
yeah,
in a weird way, it kind of gave her hope on the gay thing. But the more and more she kind of dug around and looked at, facts about some early situations with the church, she started to really question the church entirely. And it did not take very long for her to start to think that, boy, this church thing might not be exactly what it's cracked up to be. You know, and I wasn't there, but she was there. And but anyway, just saying that as a kind of a basis for what I'm about to get into. And through joining all these private Facebook groups, we realized that, you know, there was no safe landing place for gay Mormon to be. They didn't feel good at church. They felt ostracized and shunned a little bit. You know, I think unintentionally, but they still felt that way.
Yeah.
I understand both sides of it. I understand how the faithful Mormon is not intentionally trying to shun them. But I also see how the gay individual, there's no way to feel any other way.
Right.
So
the ones who are celibate, I mean, they talk about this, that even the ones who are totally living every commandment, they're still ostracized, they're marginalized, they're in this single adult category, but this hopelessly single, which means no callings, you know, or no, you know, well, they get callings, but certainly no leadership callings. And
yeah, and I mean, it's like they're...
people feel sorry for them all their life because they're suffering same-sex attraction and...
It's like they're a leper,
yeah.
And it's there's something wrong with them, and people think that they might be able to catch it if they touch them, you know, ignorantly. Yeah. And so they just treat them with love from a safe distance, which, of course, if you're loved from a distance, that's not really, you're not really being loved. And so it's a hard thing to keep doing.
Yeah.
I mean, why keep going to a place where you feel like you just don't belong? So,
and especially
in the temple, I don't understand how any gay Mormon can attend the temple and feel good about themselves. I mean, there's nothing there for them as far as eternal life goes. There is no plan laid out. Their plan is what not to do. There is no plan of what to do. And I can't imagine how frustrating that is for a believing gay Mormon to know that they just have to survive this life and wait and see what happens. Because that's pretty much the doctrine that's taught. Just wait and see.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine if that was me. Couldn't marry, couldn't fall in love, couldn't even look in that direction of a female and just say, okay, just bear through this life, and when we die, you'll get yours. Yeah. And I'm just like, ugh, it's awful. So so I had an opportunity through a Facebook friend where Meg and I were invited to meet with an apostle, one of the 12 apostles. And we had decided to attend a conference in Salt Lake in September of the same year that John came out. It was an affirmation conference, and it was a big deal. Steve Young and Barb Young came to speak. Carolyn Pearson were there. Benji Schwimmer, the dancer, came and danced. There was a lot of people, you know, who are basically Mormon affiliated and had some kind of gay affiliation were there to speak. And Meg and I had been asked to do a workshop there. It was kind of a neat, it's a really neat experience. But during that time, this particular apostle was going to be in town, and he requested to meet with us because he had heard about our story, and he said that he was intrigued at how young Mormon teens were coming out of the closet and comfortable with themselves as being homosexual. And he wanted to kind of pick our brain because he hadn't really heard of it. And even in our, even today, we still know very, very few like John who are just gay, Mormon, and cool with it. Most go through some kind of guilt, like guilt exorcism. You know, you got to get rid of that guilt to be able to survive and move on. And so John was very unique in that, right? And so he wanted to ask us about it. And the one thing that we learned over the previous 6 months or so was conversations where people wanted to tell us about things versus where people wanted to ask us about things. It was the easiest way to know what kind of person we were dealing with. If they wanted to tell us things, it was going to be a very hard, difficult, exhausting conversation. If people wanted to ask us about things, it was going to be a very spiritually uplifting, edifying opportunity. And that we learned that really, really quick early on. So we were able to judge conversations right from the beginning based on that one simple, definition. So when the apostle wanted to meet with us, we learned that he wanted to pick our brains and ask us about things. We were really excited about that, and because we thought this is a good thing, you know, and so we met with this apostle, and he just asked us, got to know us. We met with him for about an hour. He met with some other people that day, some other friends of ours as well, who were there for the conference, some of that were in similar situations. And we basically, there was two takeaways from this. We essentially asked him, there was two questions on the table that we had. And one of them wasn't really our question, but it was a question of the weekend at this conference that kept being reiterated over and over and over, was that so many gay individuals had who were in, I don't know how else to say it, but we'll call them sexually active gay relationships. I can't make that any clearer or any stronger than by saying it that way. So many of these people have prayed about their relationship and felt very strong confirmations that these relationships and their sexual activity within these relationships were perfectly condoned and appropriate in front of their God. That was like a theme of the weekend. And Daniel, you actually did a thing over lunch about this. And you had example after example after example. And that was something that was talked about with this apostle already by some of the other people. And it came up in ours as well. Obviously, John is not in that situation because he's too young. But what he said, what this apostle did say, was that personal revelation, answers to prayers, will trump overall church doctrine. Personal revelations and answers to prayers will trump. Can I say this without stuttering, Daniel? Personal revelation and answers to prayers will trump church doctrine every day of the week. And he went on to give the example of Nephi and Laban, where Nephi, of course, took Laban's sword, smote off the head of Laban because he was commanded to do so. Obviously, we're living under the law of Moses at that time, thou shalt not kill. And he was commanded to kill an innocent man, innocent by meaning unable to defend himself, man. And that was an example of personal revelation trumping the overall doctrine. You can't go up there and teach from the pulpit. It's okay to kill sometimes when it's appropriate because people will misunderstand that. But when you know in your heart that you've had an answer from your God, your Heavenly Father, that what you're doing specifically is okay, then it's okay. And so that to me was like a light bulb off my head, and that was probably one of the most comforting things that he said, and it meant so much, it made so much sense, because he referenced it to, he didn't say general conference, but he said the pulpit, which I took as meaning general conference. He basically gave the green light to kind of choose what you wanted from general conference, that it doesn't overshadow any of your personal relationship with Heavenly Father. And so that was great. And I know that gave a lot of hope to a lot of people, especially that weekend, because I know we told a lot of people that over the weekend, and several other people that met with this apostle had the same takeaway from him. And so that was really encouraging. It kind of gave me hope from the church too, as a whole, that hey, this could change down the road. Even though he did say that he did not see a possible way for the ceiling to be allowed, but for me, where I am right now, I'd be comfortable with a change of acceptance of at least a monogamous relationship on this during this life,
or at least not excommunicating people or basing worthiness on for things like priesthood and temple recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see a future of where a monogamous civil marriage between two men and a monogamous civil marriage between a man and a woman would be seen the same in the church as opportunity. You could be a gay man and be married and be an Elder Scrum president.
Yeah.
You don't need to be sealed. You can go to the temple. You can do everything. You just can't get sealed to your partner. And that was what I felt was kind of laid out as a possibility. I'll be very careful there. That is just a possibility going forward somewhere 5 years, 10 years, 105 years in the future of this church. He did not rule that out at all. He only pretty much ruled out the sealing part of it. But he didn't say it definitively. He just said, I just can't really make sense of it. So that's one thing. So the second thing that the second takeaway that we took from him is a question that I had been thinking about. Well, the second takeaway that we got was from a question that I pretty much came up with on the elevator ride on the way up to his office. For the prior couple of months, I was thinking about what questions I would ask him, and I had a whole bunch, and I was like, that's not good, that's not good, that's not good. And on the elevator ride up, I had a question come to mind that hit home to me, and I felt like it was very appropriate to ask him, and I was hoping he could shed some light. And essentially the question was this: for a gay Mormon inside the church, there's basically, you have three options. One, you can be celibate. We know that, which means no love. And we've already talked about that and how we did not feel that was a very fair life for John. Second, you could marry a woman if you're a man. And the church even now they kind of counsel against that now because they realize that that's hurting families in the long run. And so that wasn't going to be an option for John. And the only other option, well, there's four options, I guess. One, you can kill yourself. And then the fourth option is, three, you can kill yourself. And then the fourth option is you can marry a man or you can be with a man. And so that's it. I mean, you have one of those four options. And so the only option that made any sense for John is that he would be with a guy. And so we, as parents, had already accepted that as his realistic future. So, in phrasing the question, knowing so many gay men who are in relationships who still have at least one foot in the door, there is a consistent struggle that a lot of these men have in trying to live the gospel and the way that it's taught. Knowing that the doctrines teach that what they're doing is essentially a sin, but knowing that their relationship with their God, it's okay, and then wondering when they die if they'll be able to be with their partner forever and ever, or if they're going to be just swapped straight and then you're not going to care, or whatever happens, you know, according to the doctrines of the church. It's really confusing. It takes a strain on a relationship, and we want no part of that for John. And so I asked this apostle, I said, can you give me any kind of hope or any kind of reason to raise John in a church that will knowingly be problematic in his life and his happiness in his future relationships with other men? And Daniel, I was hoping that he would lean forward and kind of like put his hand on the table or grab our hands or our arm and say, just hold on. And like with a glimmer in his eye, just say, hang in there. You know what I mean? Like change is coming. That was what I was hoping for. He did not give that answer. The answer that he gave us was so personal and it was unique counsel to our family that I don't feel comfortable sharing it just in a general podcast. But I am happy to share it on an individual basis. And I've told a lot of people the answer, but it was jaw-dropping, shocking to me and very validating in a lot of ways. I would feel disrespectful to this apostle to share such private counsel in such a public manner. And so I will keep his answer privately for now, but I am more than open to talk about this with individuals on a one-on-one basis. So I hope that makes sense. Yeah. But so there's two takeaways that really gave me kind of some hope within the church that there could be some good happening. So that meeting was nice, and we had the affirmation conference the rest of the week. And the only other thing I should really kind of touch on, actually, I don't even know if Meg did, but
well, Meg, I interviewed Meg in July, so if you could talk about the affirmation conference, I think that'd be nice.
Oh, sure, okay. This same weekend that we met with the apostle, we had this affirmation conference. It basically was 2.5 days, and there were little workshops covering all kinds of things on how to set up support groups in your local area, to how to parent gay teens, how to live, you know, just a lot of different things for a lot of different people who are in different stages in life with how they're reconciling their choices with their church and their lifestyle and everything else. Meg and I were asked to kind of facilitate one of them or be on a panel for one as parents of gay teens. And so we were able to talk to a fairly large group of people and be able to answer some questions and things like that. And that was a very humbling experience where people were looking at us as like experts almost in this thing that we had been part of for about 4 months.
Yeah.
but our situation was so unique that I think we were on there because something somewhere of how we parented John, it created an environment where he felt comfortable coming to us the second that he realized that he was gay.
Yeah.
And with no hesitation. We don't really know what that is, and that's probably the question that we get asked more than any other question is, what did you guys do to be so great? You know what I mean? And it's such a humbling question, and we really don't like the question because the only answer we have is we didn't do anything. We did what every other parent should automatically think to do. Yeah. You know, you really should ask all the other parents why they're being so stupid. No offense to all the other parents, but why are we just not 100% openly accepting and putting the human element of your child before the affliction that he was born with? You know, it makes no sense to us, and it just never has. And maybe the better question is to ask our parents what they did to raise us to think like that, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's a question that we can't answer. But the conference itself, we went through the weekend, and it was Benji Schwimmer did a dance and he taught people how to dance on the opening night. John got to meet him. The very first season, for those that don't know, I mean, he won So You Think You Can Dance in the second season. And the very first time we ever watched So You Think You Can Dance, all three of us watched that entire season. And so we watched Benji win it. So we felt like we knew him really well. And this was like 7 or 8 years ago that he won, but we knew who he was. And he came in and he spoke about, because he came out a couple years ago, and he spoke about his disaffection from the Mormon church and what his process has been for him and how hard it's been for him living as an adult gay man ex-Mormon, everything, you know, and he came out and he taught everybody how to dance, and he discriminated against us straight people, Daniel. I'll never forget it. He said, everybody grab a dance partner, but it can't, you have to be, it has to be of the same sex. Anyway, it was the kind of funny thing. So I couldn't dance with Meg. We couldn't learn to dance from Benji Schwimmer together. I was like, hey, come on. Anyway, I'm kidding, but
there you go. A little bit.
But there you go.
You got to experience what we went through all our lives.
Exactly. Yeah. So now I know exactly what it's like because that was such a hard time in my life, and that is so much sarcasm. I can't be.
So who did you dance with?
So I didn't actually end up because Meg danced with somebody, John danced with somebody, and my stepfather, who was very not pro gay marriage at the beginning of this conference, I couldn't get him to dance with me. So,
dang, you should have danced with Diego. He would have danced with you.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't even think I'd met Diego at that point. But anyway, that was early. That was like the first night in.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we were there. It was kind of neat, and we kind of hung out with Benji a little bit. We told him John's story in a brief moment, and it was the funny. It was weird because about an hour later, I got a friend request from Benji on Facebook. It wasn't the other way around, so it was kind of. I showed John, and he thought that was so cool, you know.
Yeah.
and I took like a screenshot of it. And John was like, oh, my gosh. You know, and he's like, oh, look, so many famous is like wanting to be friends with my dad. And I'm like, we're all just people here. You know, this is kind of the cool thing about this. We're all just people, and we're all here kind of coming together. And that was the whole point of the whole weekend. The next night, Steve and Barb Young spoke. Carolyn Pearson spoke. You know, we had some other musical numbers. And then Benji actually did like an interpretive dance. So our family was sitting on the front row right next to the Montgomerys in front of, I don't know, 300 people, maybe. I don't know how many people were in there. It seemed like a lot. Maybe it's less than that, but
it was
in the hundreds. On the other side of us is Steve, Barb Young, and Carolyn Pearson, and Benji was up there doing his dance, and he danced to the Cyndi Lauper song "True Colors," and it was cool. And I actually took my phone out. And I just kind of set it in my lap and videotaped it, you know. And he was dancing all around, and he rolled over right in front of us at times, and it was a kind of a unique perspective. Anyway, and I stopped it, and Benji later came up to me, and he goes, "Hey, can I have that video?" And so I put it on Facebook, and it was funny because I shared it with him, and then he has like shared it a million times over.
Okay,
like that's the video I took. Yeah, that was my video because nobody else. There was a video, but I don't of the whole conference. But I don't think they videoed the dance, okay. And so that was the only video that was out there. And so he grabbed me later, and he was like, "Hey, I need to get this." And so it was kind of a funny thing. And again, John thought that was so cool, and we did too, you know. And to watch it being shared over and over and over again was cool. And since then, John will post stuff on Facebook, and Benji will continue to like stuff that John puts. And so it's kind of neat to have built that little bit of a relationship.
Yeah.
You know, that John can kind of have that, like, he had that stronghold onto. And then, you know, Steve and Barb Young spoke, and it was really cool. And Steve Young, I think he forgot that he was talking to a bunch of gay people, and he kept using a lot of football analogies, and I don't think he got the reaction to some of his public speakings that he would normally get, because he said the Super Bowl. He explained the Super Bowl, and it was so funny because he looked around and he stopped, and then he explained what the Super Bowl was. It was just it struck me as funny, you know, because he probably wasn't sure, you know. Anyway, if you're going to hit a massive stereotype or whatever,
yeah.
But it was just funny watching him realize that. So he spoke first before Barb because he knew. It was kind of neat because he knew that his name was on there to attract media attention, but he knew that he wasn't the person that people wanted to listen to. Yeah. So he spoke before Barb, and then she got up and spoke.
Well, his presence spoke volumes. He didn't have to say anything, really.
Right.
Just being there was absolutely good enough for me, you know.
Because for him, he has to be careful what he publicly endorses, and the fact that not even the fact that he, I mean, one, he put his name on it, two, he showed up, and three, he spoke. Yeah. Those are major, yeah. major things.
I wasn't going to criticize him one bit after that, yeah.
No. It's yeah. fantastic. And so so after Steve sat down, Barb spoke, and she just gave a wonderful talk that everybody in the audience could relate to. There was tears and emotion and everything, and John, who is a pretty shy kid for the most part until you get to know him, he doesn't like the stage. He doesn't like being out in public and things like that. So Barb sat down, and as Barb was sitting down, somebody else was standing up to give a closing prayer. And so they started the prayer right as Barb was sitting. And as soon as the prayer ended, there was just kind of quiet. Nobody really was doing anything yet. And John stood up and just ran, like sprinted. Keep in mind, he's not athletic. I can't believe he didn't trip. But he ran straight across the 50 feet and just hugged Barb like as tightly as I've ever seen him hug anybody. And it was so cool to watch him do that. And like everybody saw him do that.
Yeah,
you know?
This was before anyone else had even stood up. I saw
right.
him. From the
right.
Back
was,
of the, I was in the very back of the room and I was going, oh, wow. Check
it out. Was almost like it was part of the show. I mean, it was just like, it was so cool to see that. And then, you know, of course, and then everybody stood up and started talking. And people hung out for hours after there. And we talked to Barb and Steve and got some photos. And they ended up, Fox 13, 14, what's the. Fox News, Fox 13. Anyway, the local Fox radio station came and interviewed some people the next day, and they interviewed Meg, and they asked us for all the pictures that we had. And so Meg was on the news talking about John and Steve and Barb Young's talk, and they kept putting all the photos that we had. There were, of course, all of John, Meg, me, Steve and Barb Young, so they, yeah. on the news channel. So that was neat, and that link still exists. So it's like a 2-minute interview on there where we're talking about the Affirmation Conference, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
But it was all in all the Affirmation Conference was just a wonderful experience. And the coolest thing that happened from the end of the Affirmation Conference was my stepdad, who came out with my mother just to be a supportive husband. He came away from that, and this is a good old Southern boy, who is, he's 65-ish. He came away there loving gay people more than anybody on the planet. He goes, I don't know how anybody could possibly be against marriage equality. I'm going to go back to North Carolina, and I'm going to fight for this and push for this, and everybody needs to know, what are people thinking? And he was so fired up. He could not stop talking. He had so much energy about it. And it was the coolest thing because he was very traditional conservative Mormon.
Yeah.
And he still is. But on this topic, he's like, no. The church has it wrong. And
yeah.
So it's really neat to see that back in Raleigh, good old Raleigh, North Carolina. And he's in a little bit of a redneck town outside of Raleigh. So
yeah.
It's cool to see him be so vocal about it, because he doesn't shy away from it at all.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So since,
what about John though? What tell us about what kind of impact this conference had on your son?
So at the end of the conference, John had made some really good friends. He realized that he wasn't the only person like him, but he also realized that he was the only person like him. And by that, he made some friends who some other teenagers like himself, who have had to deal with some things with bullying and guilt and other things, shunning, if you will, from church. So he can't relate to that as well. But it was so good for him to be able to see people like him that were so supportive, and he didn't have to explain himself, and they understood exactly how he was. And he had never been to a church dance because he just turned 14. And the first night of Affirmation, they were dancing, and so he was out there with like four or five other kids, and they were all just dancing, and it looked like he literally had the best time of his life out there dancing with peers like himself, and he was allowed to be himself. And so now he has like lifelong friends from that weekend that he talks to on Facebook. And
well, there was a lot of us observing, you know, this going on that night, that there was all these teens there who had come with their parents, and just to see them dancing together, just having a great time. And it wasn't like, you know, nothing inappropriate. It was just a typical Mormon dance. And
yeah.
There was girl, you know, there was some gay kids, but there was also some, you know, some brothers and sisters of the gay kids who weren't even gay, but just hanging out with the teens.
It was awesome.
They were just having the best time, and it was some, like the church dance that all of us had never had, right? And so just to see the youth.
Right. I remember talking to them. Yeah, I remember talking to Randall Thacker while that was going on, and he was just off in the corner staring because he's now president of Affirmation, and he was just like beaming because he said to me, this is the future of the church, you know?
Yeah.
He said, this is like, we've never had this before, and he was just beaming. He was just on fire about the whole thing. So grateful that these kids could be open about who they were, and that Affirmation could provide a place where they could safely express themselves,
yeah,
and just be normal gay kids, which really just means be normal kids,
right?
And that was a big deal. John made some lifelong friends there, and you know, and especially he and Jordan and Sterling, and then Jordan's sister Susanna, who is a straight ally. You know, these are people that he talks to all the time on Facebook, and they communicate, and they have this bond that they'll probably never have with anybody else because they're some of the, and I'm sure there are other people, but those four became really tight, and they're some of the first, and they'll always have that bond. They have that thing in common.
Yeah.
As more and more gay kids come out, teenagers, especially Mormon, just more and more will kind of come into that fold. And we've already seen a couple since then.
Yeah.
And it's really neat. It's just neat to have been there when especially the four of them were just out there together dancing. And I have a couple of pictures of the four of them dancing. And it's really incredible. But, you know, since then, Meg, John, and I, you know, it's life. It's normal life. We got a gay teen. Other people have a straight teen. And it hasn't been that hard at school for John. And he's been really lucky. And, That's it, really.
Yeah. But, well, it's quite a journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a nice journey, and I wish more people had a story like yours to tell.
No, ours is a happy, we have a happy version of this compared to most.
Yeah.
And it may not, we need to have more happy stories because there are plenty of sad ones out there.
Exactly.
Of overcoming things. And the stuff that we've had to overcome is very different than what's been the norm.
Yeah, that's just it. I just spoke with a gay teen in a different type of interview, a gay teen and his parents. And he just said, you know, my biggest wish is that you don't have to come out, or it's just like this non-issue, you know. It's just like announcing that you like tomatoes or dislike tomatoes, you know, that it was, he really does wish that it was no bigger deal than liking or disliking tomatoes. And this was from a perspective of a gay teen. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, your family, I mean, it has been a little bit bigger deal than liking tomatoes because it's, you guys have embraced this as a cause. And that's a beautiful way to affirm your son. But in a way, even if you hadn't really chose to get involved in the activism, you have come to this in a way that really is how it should be. I mean, it should be, I mean, it's still been a big deal, but it should be less of a big deal.
Sure.
In some utopian future where it's just, where you just adjust with whatever life brings you and don't judge it. You just go with it and make the best of it. So,
you know, and I'll comment on that if I may. I was in New Orleans a couple months ago and I literally was walking up Bourbon Street cause I'd never been there.
Yeah.
And I was there for work and I was there a day early and I was like, I got a night to kill. I'm going to walk up Bourbon Street and see what it's like. Just see what it looks like.
Yeah.
And I literally walked to the end and back, but at the end, by myself, I got to the end, and I was just kind of stopping, and I was looking around as I was turning around. There's a gentleman there, this attractive Italian guy who was about 30 years old, and he started to hit on me, you know, and he started approaching me And he goes, I might be barking up the wrong tree, you know. And and he was, and I let him know he was. And it wasn't a big deal at all. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I said my kid's gay, you know. And no, you know, dude, no worries. You know, good luck to you. And that was really it. And I think to speak to, like, you have that other gay teen, I would imagine in his world, he would want being gay be the same. Someone straight comes up and talks to you, and it can just be like, oh, no, you're barking up the wrong tree. I'm gay.
Yeah.
And it's over. It's the end of it.
Yeah.
And that should be, I mean, you do need to state at some point if you're gay or you're straight.
Right.
As you pursue relationships, obviously.
Obviously.
But yeah. It should just be a matter of fact and not a big declaration. And I totally agree with that. And that's how John came out. It wasn't a major declaration. It was just, are you gay? Yeah. Oh. The end.
Yeah.
You know, and that was it. So, yeah, there you go.
There you go.
So, anyway.
Well, Jake, thanks a lot for taking the time. And thanks a lot for being the kind of parent that not only does right by your son, but also sets an amazing role model. And I really hope that a lot of people realize that they can be parents like you. And it just might be harder for them to realize that. I may not be so many people that will realize it as easy as you, but hopefully once they at least take the first steps, they'll find it, get there easier. And I also want to thank you and Meg and Jake and John, your son, for the activism you do and your involvement in this cause, because it's just really, really, the experience you had in the Pride Parade happens really with anyone who meets you guys, that people just really feel the loss that they had in their Mormonism of being sort of shunned by their community. And to see a parent adopt the cause for the sake of their son touches people in a way that is really meaningful. And maybe it's not, maybe part of it is sadness that they couldn't have had that from their family, but still it does inspire and heal when they see that there is a generation of people who is starting to have a different experience. So I'm excited for the future, and I'm excited to see what you guys do coming up and how you stay involved. And so I really want to thank you for hanging out and doing this podcast.
Oh, no, it's completely my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity to have a little bit of a opportunity just to speak out and to share our story. So thanks for the, you know, thanks for the, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh, the
memories, the platform.
Yeah. Thanks for the platform to be out there, you know, to be out there and share our story. So,
yeah. Well, and you can look forward to Jake and Meg also, and John doing a video interview in the Walk With You project. And so you'll hopefully see and hear more from them in these different kind of medias. Anyway, I will call it over and out.
Awesome. Until
the next episode.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see the podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation today at gaymormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Nabby Parkinson Folk and Ricky Parkinson. That thou hast shown, pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own. Savior, may I learn to love thee.
walking perfectly in the quiet heart is hidden sorrow that the eye can't see. Ooh, who am I to judge?